Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. You know, whenever we start digging into the absolute fundamentals of biology, we inevitably run into...
into the ultimate biological chicken or egg scenario.
Exactly. I mean, we know that life, as it exists right now, relies on DNA and RNA to store information.
Yeah, and it relies on proteins to actually do the structural and chemical work.
Right, so today RNA holds the critical instructions required to build those proteins, but that creates a massive paradox for anyone studying biogenesis.
It really does. You absolutely need proteins to build and replicate the RNA in the first place.
So how could life possibly start if both sides of the equation need the other to exist?
Well, it is a closed loop of dependency that has, frankly, troubled scientists for decades.
Mm.
And to resolve it, the scientific consensus traditionally assumed that one of these complex molecules just had to go it alone in the very beginning.
Right, the famous RNA world hypothesis.
Exactly. This became the leading model. A lonely, highly unstable, RNA-only world. The assumption was that RNA emerged as the first functional molecule, acting as both the genetic hard drive and the physical worker.
Long before proteins ever entered the picture.
Right, long before.
I've always pictured that scenario like trying to build a massive, fully automated robotic factory.
Right.
But you need the exact robots from the factory to assemble the factory itself.
That is a great way to think about it.
Finding a way to get that very first machine running seems mathematically impossible without an external catalyst. I mean, we have just accepted this idea of the RNA-only world for so long.
We have, yeah.
But what if the simple building blocks of proteins were actually the biochemical midwives that birthed the first functional RNA? I want you to hold on to that image as we jump into today's deep dive. How could the presence of simple amino acids rewrite our understanding of life's first sparks on early Earth?
It really forces us to completely flip the script. We're looking at a scenario where RNA didn't have to struggle through those early evolutionary stages entirely on its own.
Which elegantly untangles that chicken or egg problem.
It does, by pointing to a mutualistic relationship from day one.
Well, today we celebrate the work of Suraj K. Rout, Dieter Braun, and an international coalition of researchers across LMU Munich, the Czech Academy of Sciences, the National Research Council of Italy, and University College London, who have advanced our understanding of the chemical origins of life.
It is a truly massive collaborative effort.
It is. And this research was published in Nature Communications in June 2025. Mm. But stepping back from the page for a moment, how does a physically scattered global team actually collaborate to investigate a 4-billion-year-old cold case?
Yeah, you cannot solve a mystery this ancient through the lens of just one discipline. I mean, it requires a massive synthesis of different scientific dialects.
Different dialects, I like that.
Well, it is true. You have experimental biophysicists in Munich running the physical reactions to see what forms.
And then you have chemists in London synthesizing the raw prebiotic precursor molecules from scratch.
Right.
Exactly. And then you have theoretical physicists in Italy and the Czech Republic running massive quantum computational simulations.
Wow.
Yeah, they use supercomputers to map the electromagnetic pull of every single atom on a time scale of picoseconds.
So you need the physical data to prove a reaction happens and the quantum modeling to explain the invisible physics of why it happens.
Precisely. Now let's talk about the biological problem they were trying to solve.
Because if RNA was the first spark of life, it had a massive uphill battle.
Oh, absolutely. Forming long, stable RNA chains spontaneously from scratch is incredibly difficult. On early Earth, you would have had these raw nucleotide building blocks floating around, but without the complex modern enzymes we have in our cells today, they just do not link up efficiently.
They're just too sluggish.
Right, they bump into each other and bounce off. So previous attempts to force these non-enzymatic RNA chains to form in the lab relied on some pretty extreme, biologically unrealistic conditions.
Right, like researchers were baking the chemical soup at 85 degrees Celsius,
yeah,
or throwing in unnatural chemical activators.
Or flooding the system with high concentrations of magnesium.
But that magnesium workaround is especially problematic for the origin of life, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, in modern chemistry, we frequently use metal ions like magnesium to help kickstart reactions.
Sure, it is a standard tool.
And to be fair, High magnesium concentrations do force single RNA strands to form, but it acts like a molecular superglue.
Wait, superglue? How so?
Well, magnesium ions have a strong positive charge, and the backbone of a new RNA strand is highly negative. The magnesium binds so tightly to the backbone that once a double strand forms, the two sides cannot pull apart.
Which means the engine seizes up immediately. If the strands cannot separate, they cannot act as a template to be copied.
Exactly.
And without copying, you do not get replication, which is the absolute prerequisite for Darwinian evolution to even begin.
Precisely. So the researchers in this study hypothesized that amino acids, you know, the simple building blocks of proteins, which we know were abundant on early Earth, might have acted as natural catalysts for RNA formation instead of magnesium.
They wanted to see if amino acids could build the chains without gluing them shut.
Right.
But that sounds like a neat solution, but isn't it essentially cheating to just introduce amino acids at this stage?
Cheating.
Yeah, like, if the prevailing theory in the field is the RNA-only world, why should we assume protein building blocks were even present to help out?
That is a great point, and it is the first critique a defender of the pure RNA world would raise. But recent discoveries in prebiotic chemistry show it is not cheating at all.
Really?
Yeah, amino acids and RNA precursors actually share the exact same divergent chemical pathways.
Oh, so they come from the same place.
Exactly. They form from the identical raw materials, things like hydrogen cyanide and water, under the exact same environmental conditions. Chemically speaking, they would have inevitably shared the same puddle on early Earth.
So they were roommates from the very beginning.
Exactly, roommates.
That completely changes the context. If they are in the same neighborhood, how did the researchers go about recreating that specific ancient puddle in a modern lab? Like, what actually goes into the beaker to test this?
The experimental setup is beautifully simple, relying on a method called dry state polymerization.
Okay, dry state.
Right, they started with naturally occurring prebiotic precursors to RNA, ribonucleoside 2 prime 3 prime cyclic phosphates, or CNMPs, essentially the raw nucleotide building blocks before they form a chain.
And they mix those with amino acids.
Yes, they mix these precursors with various simple protein-building amino acids in plain, nuclease-free water.
Just water, building blocks, and amino acids. No boiling heat or unnatural activators.
None at all. They adjusted the acidity of these mixtures to range anywhere from highly acidic at pH 3 all the way to highly alkaline at pH 12.
Okay.
Then they placed small drops of this mixture on a glass slide and rapidly dried them under a nitrogen flow. After the water evaporated, they just left the dried drops to incubate at a comfortable room temperature, about 25 degrees Celsius.
So just a nice, mild day.
Exactly, and they left them for 20 hours.
You know, evaporating the water seems like a crucial mechanical step there.
It absolutely is.
Because water is a great solvent. But when you want two biological molecules to link together, they usually have to release a water molecule in the process.
Right, it is a condensation reaction.
So if you surround them in an ocean of water, the physical pressure actually pushes the reaction backward. By drying the puddle out, the evaporation removes that water buffer and physically forces the amino acids into tight contact with the RNA precursors.
Exactly. That physical concentration is what drives the chemical reaction forward in the absence of complex enzymes.
So instead of visualizing a sterile lab slide, picture a puddle of nucleotide-rich water on a volcanic rock on early Earth, slowly drying out in the afternoon sun, concentrating the chemicals together.
That is exactly the scenario. Yeah. So after those 20 hours, the researchers rehydrated the samples in water to extract whatever had formed in that dry state.
And how did they actually see what formed?
To analyze the results, they deployed some serious analytical technology. They used highly sensitive, calibrated HPLC ESI TOEF mass spectrometry. Think of it as a microscopic sorting machine that can separate and weigh every single molecule in that droplet.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and by looking at the exact mass of the outputs, they could calculate exactly how many nucleotides linked together to form RNA chains. They also used nuclear magnetic resonance, specifically 31P NMR, to quantify the oligomers.
But they didn't just weigh them though, right?
No, they paired that physical chemistry with advanced classical and quantum molecular dynamic simulations to visualize the atomic interactions.
So out of this microscopic dried up puddle, what actually crystallized when they looked at the mass spectrometry data?
The primary breakthrough was a massive, unprecedented boost in RNA formation. The amino acids acted as highly efficient acid-base catalysts without any extra chemical activator.
Nice, so it worked.
It did. When the environment reached an alkaline pH of 9 to 10, the formation of RNA chains increased more than 100-fold compared to the samples that had no amino acids present.
Wait, 100-fold increase? Just from adding a simple amino acid?
Yes.
What is so special about that specific alkaline pH level of 9 to 10?
That pH perfectly matches the specific acid dissociation constant, or pKa, of the amino acids.
Right, the tipping point of acidity.
Exactly. Hmm. At a pH of 9 to 10, the amino acid essentially becomes dual purpose. Picture a molecular seesaw.
Okay, seesaw.
At this specific pH, half of the amino acid molecules are in a base form, meaning they are perfectly positioned to pull a proton away from the RNA precursor to start the chemical reaction.
And the other half?
The other half are in an acid form, ready to donate a proton to help the reaction finish. It acts exactly like a massive modern enzyme does, but it accomplishes it using just one tiny, simple molecule balancing on that chemical seesaw.
That is incredibly efficient.
Yeah.
But you know, just making a longer chain of RNA doesn't necessarily mean you've made anything biologically useful. 100 times more chemical sludge is still sludge.
That is the most critical data point in this study, actually. It leveled the playing field.
How so?
Without the amino acids, the system was overwhelmingly biased. It heavily favored linking just one of the four genetic letters, guanine or G. It had about a 26% yield.
Okay, and what about the others?
The other three letters, A, U, and C, barely showed up. They had trace yields of less than 1%.
Which means you just end up with a microscopic block of solid Gs. It cannot base pair properly, it cannot fold into the complex 3D shapes required for life, and it certainly cannot encode diverse genetic information.
Exactly the opposite of what life requires. It is a useless clump of RNA. But with the addition of the amino acid valine to the mixture, the C oligomerization jumped 122-fold.
122-fold? That is massive.
Yeah, and the A nucleotides jumped 49-fold. By boosting those weaker, sluggish nucleotides, the amino acids fundamentally altered the resulting RNA pool.
It went from a monolithic clump of Gs to a rich, diverse sequence of RNA.
Exactly. Because you finally have an even distribution of the letters A, U, C, and G, you can have actual base pairing. You can form the double-stranded RNA that is the necessary stepping stone to replication.
And the physical quality of these chains, were they structured correctly? Because when molecules link up spontaneously in nature, they usually form messy, branching, chaotic clumps.
That is the other amazing part. 58 to 66% of the RNA chains formed canonical 3 prime to 5 prime phosphodiester linkages.
So they avoided the tangled mess entirely.
Yes. What crystallized out was a clean, readable biological spine. It is the exact same structural backbone that connects the DNA and RNA in your cells today.
Which brings us back to those quantum simulations. Because the team wanted to know why certain amino acids built that biological standard better than others.
Right. The simulations gave us an incredible insight there. They showed that hydrophobic, or water-fearing, amino acids like valine, leucine, and isoleucine were the absolute best at catalyzing this clean RNA formation.
Wait, that feels completely counterintuitive.
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah, if these molecules are interacting in a water droplet that is actively drying out, why do the water-fearing amino acids do the best job at building the RNA?
Well, it seems like a paradox, but the quantum simulations proved it wasn't about the general environment. Rather, the hydrophobic amino acids physically preferred to localize and tuck themselves right up against the cyclic phosphate center of the RNA precursors.
Oh, to escape the water.
Exactly. By trying to hide from the water, they form perfect hydrogen bonds directly at the reaction site. Their water-fearing nature forces them into the exact physical arrangement needed to act as a catalyst.
That is just brilliant. But creating a beautifully diverse, perfectly structured pool of RNA in a high-tech lab is an incredible feat of physical chemistry. How does this highly specific process, this wet to dry pH 9 to 10 environment, actually translate to the grander biological timeline and the harsh geological reality of early Earth?
It translates remarkably well because it solves the massive replication hurdle we discussed earlier.
Right, the magnesium superglue problem.
Exactly. Because this amino acid-driven process doesn't rely on magnesium, the newly formed RNA strands don't get permanently stuck together.
So they form, and then they can easily separate.
Yes, which allows for templated replication to actually happen. You finally have a workable, unseized engine.
And the specific environmental constraints required here, like fresh water, low salt, and a highly alkaline pH, they perfectly match modern geological models of early Earth.
They really do. Specifically, low-temperature volcanic environments like the ones we see in Iceland today.
Places where you have alkaline, carbonate-rich lakes, porous rocks that provide a physical scaffold for the molecules to rest on, and regular wet-dry cycles driven by day and night.
The mechanics of that wet-dry cycle are vital to the whole engine. The day provides the geothermal heat and sunlight to evaporate the puddle, removing the water buffer, concentrating the amino acids and RNA precursors, and physically driving the chemical polymerization forward.
And then the night brings the dew and moisture to rehydrate the puddle.
Right. That rehydration spreads the newly formed RNA char out so they can find new templates to copy.
And there is a brilliant recycling mechanism built into this specific alkaline environment too.
Yeah, this is a key feature.
Because RNA degrades naturally. The bonds break down in water over time through a process called hydrolysis. But the paper notes that at this specific pH of 9 to 10, when the RNA breaks down, it doesn't just turn into useless molecular waste.
No, it reverts right back into those active 2', 3' cyclic phosphates.
So it essentially creates a self-recycling loop of active building blocks.
Exactly. The destruction of one chain immediately refuels the raw materials needed for the creation of the next. It is a highly robust, sustainable chemical ecosystem.
That elegance is hard to ignore. But, you know, we do need to acknowledge the limitations of this specific study and the next steps.
Certainly. This research specifically looked at proteinogenic amino acids, the ones that life already uses today. It is highly likely there were other non-biological amino acids present on early Earth, and we don't yet know how they would interact in this cycle.
And modeling more complex amino acid interactions remains computationally expensive.
Yeah. Extremely expensive. They could only simulate the relatively simple interactions between single amino acids and nucleotides. Future research must uncover more of these cross-catalytic mechanisms.
To understand exactly how this simple relationship eventually evolved into the complex modern genetic code, but I want to raise a philosophical pushback for you to consider.
Okay.
Does this research definitively kill the pure RNA-only world hypothesis? Are we officially replacing it with an RNA peptide coevolution world?
Based on this evidence, I believe it fundamentally rewrites the timeline of biogenesis. It validates that exact shift.
Wow.
It proves that amino acids possessed a functional, necessary role in RNA evolution far earlier than the scientific community ever assumed. RNA was never struggling alone in the primordial soup.
So, if you had to distill this massive international physics and chemistry study into a central insight for the listener to walk away with, what is the core takeaway?
I would say this. Amino acids naturally and powerfully catalyze the formation of diverse, long RNA strands under early Earth conditions without the need for complex enzymes. This establishes that the fundamental building blocks of proteins and genetics relied on a mutualistic relationship from the very origin of life.
That interconnectedness at the very dawn of biology is just beautiful. It leaves me with a thought-provoking prompt I want you to mull over as we wrap up. What does this mean for the search for life on other planets, where we might detect amino acids in the soil, but haven't yet found any RNA? Maybe finding them isn't just finding an inert building block. Maybe it means the machinery of life is already trying to build itself.
That is a fascinating thought.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Fine. At 9 to 10, the world clicks. stitch a future where the letters can write.
Rhyme.